It says for me to introduce the topic. I don't know about that. So I'm going to introduce the speaker and I'm going to give a brief commentary. Railroad Bob, and he's here to tell us his story. That's my commentary. Get on with me, Bob.
And back up, didn't get one.
I'm Bob, and I'm an alcoholic.
I'm glad Roy didn't say I was a speaker because I'm not a speaker. But I love to talk. And I love to talk about the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love to talk about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And every time I think about making a talk or being a speaker, I remember the time that I was privileged to hear in 1979, I was privileged to meet and hear Bear Bryant up in Tennessee. And Bear's whole talk was on the fact that he wasn't a speaker and never had been a speaker. And he said he had to give a talk out in Palm Springs and he had to follow Bob Hope. And he said when he stood up there and started talking, there was two old boys, probably two of us, were sitting down at the table, and they said, sending that fella up there to talk after Bob Hope's like sending a hog to a beauty parlor. So that's about what I feel like tonight, a hog in a beauty parlor. Speedy gave me my opening line. I was born. But Speedy's just been sober 20 years, and he's my sponsor. What in the hell does he know? I ain't going to start that way. The privilege to share the experience, strength, and hope that this program has given me, because I have the disease of alcoholism. I was at a meeting the other night, and they were talking about the miracle of AA, and I thought, you know, the miracle that I found here was the opportunity to be sober. I think God took the compulsion to drink from me for a short period of time, and He left me the choice. And in that choice was all the adventure that I've had in sobriety. I like to do this because I like to start out by saying I have a psychosocial, biogenetic, tridimensional disease of alcoholism. An outward, invisible manifestation of an inward drinking problem. I can't drink and I can't quit. And that's the reason I'm here. But I didn't know that for a long time. I thought there was something else wrong with me. I felt inadequate, and I felt full of fear, and I felt like nothing was ever going to be all right in my life. I'm going to go ahead and take my watch off now, because I can't see that clock back there through the smoke.
I'll let you know.
And I'll help you keep track of the time, Roy. Old boy took his son to church one morning, and the preacher did that, you know. He took his watch off and laid it up on the podium, and his little boy said, "What does he mean by doing that, Daddy?" And he said, "Not a damn thing." But I'm going to try not to be too long-winded tonight. My wife's been out of town for about 10 days. She's been in South America, and she came home today. And so I'll be a little anxious to get home. And I'm glad you have this podium like this. I like to stand behind something when I'm talking because over at Jim City, when I celebrated my fourth birthday one time, I was standing up in front of those people, you know, and doing the things that we do on our birthdays. I was telling them how much I appreciated them and how much I loved them. And there was an old boy that had just got out of the hospital, was sitting right down front, and he kept trying to tell me something, and he was sort of slurring his words, you know. And I finally got back over and sat down. I said, "George, what in the hell was you trying to tell me?" He said, "Your pants is unzipped." And they were. So if I have any problems tonight and if my pants get unzipped, or if I get to thinking about later on tonight, see, I'm behind this podium. glad you speak his line, because I really don't know any other place to start except to say I was born in 1939. May the 21st, 1939 at 11:42 p.m. And that was about a month after they had published the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I believe to this day that God already knew was going to need the book, so he got it on the market and got it ready for me. I also believe that I was born predisposed to be an alcoholic. I think that I was born because of being Irish. I had the Irish disease. I was born with a weak alcohol filter. And I chose to drink enough to break that filter, and now it can't be replaced nor repaired. That's the disease, the physical disease of alcoholism to me. All the time when I was growing up in this little town in Tennessee, I spoke last night, by the way, and I'm going to try not to tell the same story, and I hope nobody was here that was there last night, because it's boring as hell. And I really don't like to do that, but I also hate to lie to people about why I can't do things. And Roy's asked me several times to come over here, and I've always had one excuse or the other, and the excuses wore out. So bear with me. If you were with me last night, Speedy also called my wife and told her that if I wake up in the morning with a headache, to just take the screwdriver and loosen my halo a little bit, and I'll be all right. Because I do get into some halotosis sometimes, you know. Get pretty good. But I don't think I was ever involved in anything as a child that didn't. I said last night it was a sense of inadequacy, and I think now it was fear. I was afraid of everything. I was afraid to stay, and I was afraid to go. I was afraid to not, and I was afraid to do. Everything that in my life as a child and in my drinking career was based on that old bugaboo fear. And even after I started drinking and started drinking heavily, you know, people would say to me, Bob, if you don't quit drinking, you're going to die. If you don't quit drinking, you're going to lose your job. If you don't quit drinking, you're going to lose your family. And all of those things, they were trying to cure me with the same damn thing that I was full of, fear. It reminds me of a story about an old boy that was one of us, and he was married to a lady whose brother was an undertaker. And they decided they'd scare him sober. So they got this casket and hid it in the house, and they dug him a grave while he was out drinking. And he came home and he passed out on the couch, and they put him in that casket, you know, and they put him in the ground, covered him up. And run a pipe out to the top of the ground, and the old boy woke up. And he said, hey, what's going on here? Where am I? And the undertaker up at the top of the ground said through the pipe, he said, you're dead. He said, the hell I am. How long have I been dead? He said, about 6 or 7 hours. He said, where you at? He said, I'm dead too. And he said, how long you been dead? He said, oh, about 10 years. He said, hell, if you've been dead that long, you all know where we can get a drink. Trying to scare a drunk into getting sober is ridiculous. First job, and I was born in the little town I was raised in. If any of you know anything about the hills of Tennessee, In the early 40s and 50s and 60s, it's a whiskey state. It's the home of Jack Daniels and George Dickel and some homemade recipes. And the little town that I grew up in, it was whiskey was a way of life for us. There was people that made it, and there was people that hauled it, and there was people that sold it, and there was people that drank it. And people that hated it. And the first job I ever had as a 12-year-old child was a bootlegger. And I was a curb hop at a little barbecue place, a drive-in place. And what they did, it was a dry county, of course, and they sold bonded whiskey, government whiskey, they called it. And it was, of course, illegal to do that. Now, if you don't know what a dry county is a place that you can get a drink anytime, anywhere, if you know the right people. And that was my first job, and it was also my first memory work that I could remember. And you know, for some reason, I don't remember Julius Caesar, the memory work we did there. I don't remember Thanatopsis and the Gettysburg Address. But you know what I remember? Old Crow, Old Quaker, Tom Moore, Jack Daniel, Seagram, Shinley, Gilby's, and Dixieville Gin. That was our stock. And I memorized that when I was 12 years old, and I still know it. That ought to tell us something, you know? It really ought to tell us something. I went to high school in that little town, and I suppose I did most things that, you know, normal, whatever normal is. The children did. I played baseball and I played football. Was a fairly decent scholar. Drank a little in high school, not a great deal. Got out of high school and joined the Army in 1958 and went through basic training over Fort Jackson. And they sent me to a drinker's paradise. They sent me to the Republic of Western Germany where they have that flip-top beer. And it'll set you back. You know, a couple of bottles of that and you'd be right. And I was at home. Because I was all of a sudden, I was with a group of people that's what they did for a recreation. That's what they did for a hobby. We built telephone lines and drank. That's what we did. But I still think that I was more or less of an alcohol abuser. I'm not one of those people that took the first drink and immediately drank alcoholically. As a matter of fact, the first time that I got drunk, I'm told about, I don't remember at all because I was just 3 years old. My oldest brother and my oldest sister and myself decided we needed to test my dad's homemade wine. And we got the dipper out of the water bucket, and we tested it, and they tasted it, and I drank the dipper full and fell in the toilet. But it didn't go downhill from there, you know. I was given a little opportunity to continue to drink, maybe in a recreational mode. I don't know, and it's not important to me anymore how I drink. It's not important to me that I had all of that fancy language that I told you in the beginning about the disease of alcoholism. The only damn thing that's important to me is I got it. I got it. I was talking to a newcomer not too long ago. He said, I don't think I'm an alcoholic. I don't think I have the disease of alcoholism. I said, what difference does it make? What difference does it make whether you think you're an alcoholic or not? If you got it, you got it. You can't drink and you can't quit. It don't make no difference what you call yourself. You can't drink. I came home from the Army. I got married when I was in the Army. I got married in 1960. Now, I'm not the product of a broken home. I've not had two or three wives. I'm not a recovering Catholic. I don't have the disease of Southern Baptism. I'm just your common, ordinary, sidetracked drunk. I'm married to the same lady today that I married January the 24th, 1960, which will shortly be 27 years. Why that woman stayed with me, I have absolutely no idea. You know, it says in the big book, Dr. Bob says alcoholics tend to marry the best people in the world, and I think that must be the truth. She's mostly responsible for me being here today and being alive today because she was a great enabler for me. She's the one that did the telephone calls and told him I had the flu. She's the one that called the boss and said, Bob can't make it today. He needs to rest. Bob was passed out. He was already rested. I went to work on the railroad, and that was another deal that was great. know, you can work on the railroad and you're away from home a lot and you're in this town and you're in that town and nobody knows you and you can be anything you want to, you know. Hell, I've been a Catholic priest, I've been a doctor, I've been a lawyer, I've been all those things, you know, in these different towns and different bars. When the Holiday Inn on Delt Road opened over here, my wife and I had gone out there for dinner and I was already pretty well in the bag, you know. And there was a lady over in the corner and she's having a fit. She's laying there kicking her feet and screaming she wanted her child. And people had gathered around her, you know, and I got up from the table and put my napkin down. I said, get out of the way, I'll take care of her, I'm a doctor. They partied, you know, and I got down in the floor with that lady, just took the tablecloth off the table, covered her up, propped her feet up a little bit, you know. John, I'd heard you do that. And I sat there on the floor and held her hand and I talked to her a few minutes and the lady quit crying. She stood up and told her husband she's ready to go home. And they got up and quietly left the restaurant. And on the way out, the gentleman said to me, he said, sir, can I have your card? You're the only person I've ever seen that could do anything with her. I said, well, to tell you the truth, I'm in private practice and I've got more patients than I can handle. Now, of course, today I know exactly what that was. That was one drunk talking to another drunk, and both of us knew the damn lie was over. But those are the things that I was in these different towns, you know, in different places. But I could just be anybody. I could be a paratrooper. Whew, I used to tell people I was a lot taller, but I got sick. I came home from a railroad trip one time, and my wife had told me that, and this is the truth as I remember it. This is also my opinion as I believe it tonight, subject to change before I get on. But this is the truth as I remember it, and we were going to church, to an Episcopal church. She was going to an Episcopal church in Cartersville. Now, I had already decided the church was not for me. And I tell these things, and I don't tell them to be funny. I tell them because of the truth. The days that I would go to church with my family, I'd drink on the way to church. I drank on the way to everywhere. And it was no big deal. The family would get up to go to the altar for Holy Communion, and I'd go to the car. Because my communion was better than theirs. They weren't going to give you much, and it was weak anyway. But we were going to church in Cartersville, and she got involved in a thing called I'm Okay and You're Okay in a Sunday school class. And one night I came in, and she said, if you're home Friday night, I wish you'd go with me. And I said, sure, you know, the little girl's got problems. Something's wrong, and I better go with her to help her. What she was going to was an Al-Anon meeting. I had no idea what Al-Anon was about. But I told her, I said, sure, hon, if you're having problems, I'll go with you. And, you know, I can explain it to you on the way home. We got up to Cartersville, and she said, my meeting is in here. Yours is over there. And I walked in that meeting, and it was an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. This must have been somewhere around 1974. And I took one look at that crew, and I said, oh, hey, scruffy-looking people, you know. Sitting around there laughing and giggling and telling them old drunk stories about what they used to do when they was drinking. And the speaker got up there, and I, you know, of course I don't know what that speaker talked about that night, and that's not important. What I heard was, he had probably drowned his child in the bathtub, and he put the cat in the microwave, and he lost his fortune, and two or three jobs, and his life was just miserable. And this lady got up, and she said, you know, wasn't that a fantastic talk? And they all clapped, and I thought, I can help these people. So when they asked if you want to take a white chip and join them, I said, yeah. took that white chip and I went up there the next week, you know. Of course, May, I had to have a couple of drinks before I went. As a matter of fact, Pinky Lee, if y'all ever get a chance to hear him from Cartersville, he'll tell you the rest of the story. I always had to have a couple of drinks, you know, to get the courage to go up there and help those folks. And they asked me the second time I'd been there if anyone wanted to read how it works, and of course I volunteered. I got up there and I had heard it the week before and it was boring as hell. I didn't really see any sense of reading it every week. I thought, you know, they heard it last week. So I read it and I ad-libbed some. It took me about 20 minutes to read it. Because I'd have to tell a little something. Tuesday night at Gym City we had a gym, and I won't get into that, but a fellow walked in there that so reminded me of me and those Cartersville meetings, you know.
Yeah, I want to talk a little.
That's the way I was. Now I went back up there and made amends to those people. I owed it. I sort of waited a while, though. I figured they'd forget me. But I walked in that meeting up there that night to make those amends, and there sat one of them, you know. We've got him in here. You see him everywhere you go. He's sitting right there and said, yeah, been wondering if you'd make it back. He remembered me. I took that white chip and I made a trip to Chattanooga, and of course I had joined the great fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, never to drink again. I would never drink again. It's all over. And I walked in the bar in Chattanooga and sat down, and they said, what do you have, Bob, scotch and water? And I said, no. Took that white chip and laid it up on the counter, and I said, I've joined Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll never take another drink as long as I live. My wife had asked me if I thought it was possible, could I go all month without a drink? And I said, yeah, that's no big deal. It's no big deal to go a month without taking a drink. I chose February. It didn't happen for 28 days. Drinking was not important in my life. It was no big deal. And I had to lie about that because it didn't work. And I had to lie about that 28 days. And because of the things that I heard in those meetings up there, I heard people say the bad things that had happened to them, the things that they'd lost from drinking. And I said, you know, and I went home and convinced my wife that there was no way I could possibly be an alcoholic. I hadn't lost a job. Hell, I've got a promotion. I hadn't lost my family. They were still with me. I didn't know at the time it wasn't going to be for much longer. But I hadn't lost all of these things. I was not bad like those people were. You see, I heard bad. I didn't hear sick, and I wasn't bad, so I couldn't possibly be an alcoholic. And I said, I'm just going to cut down. I'm going to cut down. I'm just going to drink on one end of the road. That didn't work either. That didn't work either. And for the next 5 years, my drinking went all downhill. It's my belief tonight that if me or any other human being, any other one of God's kids ever walks into a meeting and says, my name is Bob and I'm an alcoholic, it's a pretty good idea. He needs to mean it. He needs to want a little of something that he finds in. Because the fun drinking was all over. There was no more whoopee bottles, if there ever had been. And it went downhill. And I bought me a little pedal car. I bought a little four-cylinder sports car because I always wanted to be one of those people. You know, suave and debonair and shifting gears and wearing that little hat. And I bought me one of those. Never have been in jail. Never have been locked up in jail. But I took a trip to Jekyll Island. An alcoholic like, I took two little children with me. And I knew if those two little children were in the car with me and they stopped me for driving under the influence, they would lock me out. Now, how I knew that, I didn't know. But they didn't. They stopped me in Cordial, Georgia, and they put me in a Holiday Inn. And the sheriff and his wife came over later that night, and we finished up the gin that was in the car, and we bought some more. And we talked about Tennessee football, and we talked about drinking gin, and damn truck drivers, Cecil, that got me in trouble. They're the ones that reported me. Just because I was taking that little sports car and running under their trailers and things like that. I called my wife and I said, I got to have $200, you know, that's the fine. She said, where in the world am I going to get $200? It's 10 o'clock at night. And I said, I don't have any idea. Just get it. She got it. She went to the liquor store, you see. Those liquor stores would always cash my checks. Because they knew damn well I was coming back. She went to the liquor store that night and cashed the check for the $200 and sent me the fine. And I went home to Jekyll Island. I didn't... She said, I thought surely you'd come home after that. And I thought, why the hell would she think I'd come home? I didn't know where I started. I was going down to Jekyll Island all the time. But I got to where I was nervous. You people probably never have had this, but I'm, you know, I got to where I was nervous and my hands sweated a lot and my heart had beat awful fast and I get this little sweat on me, you know. I got scared I was going to have a heart attack. So I went to the doctor and he said, Bob, what your problem is, you're nervous. And I'm going to give you a prescription for Valium. They'll fix you right up, you know, and they did. They did. He gave me 2 milligrams, told me to take 2 a day. I got the druggist to give me 6 milligrams, took them 10 times a day. I don't know. I eat the damn things like popcorn, just exactly like I drink liquor. And I never really thought that Valium was important to me. That's the reason I say I'm not a drug addict. I never really thought anything about being a drug addict. Because when the doctor told me that I needed to get off that Valium and quit it, I just quit it. It was no big deal. Now, the same doctor told me to quit drinking or I was going to die. And 14 years later, I heard him. So I don't know. I really don't know about that. But I know that that Valium allowed me to quit vibrating to sit on an engine long enough to do what job I had been hired to do. I'd gone through an apprentice engineer program and I was a railroad engineer and I thought that was the apex. I thought that was the height. That's what I always wanted to be. It wasn't enough. Nothing had ever been enough and this wasn't either. Simply was not enough. We took that little sports car, my son and I again. We took a trip up to Tennessee. I wanted to get in the mountains where I could be Mario Andretti, you know, shifting gears and I can swallow around the curves. And for a long time, I would have bet you any amount of money that I was not drunk when I wrecked that car. About 6 months after my son and I got out of the hospital, he said, Dad, I bet that hitchhiker is glad he got out the way he did. I didn't know we'd ever picked up a hitchhiker. While I was in that hospital, of course, with my luck, it happened to be a railroad company doctor, and he knew everything about it. He came in my room the last day I was there, and he said, before I discharge you, I need to talk to you about something. Now, see, I gut level knew, already knew what that man needed to talk to me about. I knew what he was going to say, boy. I knew he was going to say something about my drinking. I lived in fear of people saying something about my drinking. is always scared they're going to say, you're going to have to quit. And he said, you're going to have to cut down on that drinking. My kind of doctor. You know, I'm told that the medical profession took those little rubber hammers and beat the knees off of a million drunks. The psychiatrist recognized our problem and diagnosed it as a Valium deficiency and killed a hell of a lot more of them. And the preachers and the ministers said, you ought not to do that. And you know, I already knew I ought not to do that. I didn't know how to not do it. But my wife came down there and picked me up in that hospital and she said, the first question that all them little ladies will ask you, you know, what do you say about your drinking? And I said, honey, he told me that I needed to lay off the hard stuff, that I needed to just drink beer and wine. Would you take me over by the store and let me get a six-pack, you know? And then it began to really, really go downhill. I got to where it was impossible for me to function without drinking. That was the first thought in my mind when I got up. And when I passed out at night, I always wanted to know the last thing was, have I got anything to get up with in the morning? Because I couldn't make it without it. I remember having my wife put me in the car and drive me down to St. Simon's Island. There was a little church down there, Christ Episcopal Church, that I loved to go sit in the cemetery. Of all places for a drunk to go sit in the graveyard, on a tombstone, to talk to God, drunk. And I talk about God, and I don't apologize for that. A man told me one time, he said, you know, you talk too much about God and you'll run a newcomer off. And an old timer told me, hell, that don't make no difference. Liquor will run him right back in you. But that's where I went to talk to God. Sitting on a tombstone at the church. Now, I wasn't going inside. I had been inside their churches and I couldn't hear anything. I've been inside the fraternal organizations and I couldn't hear anything. I couldn't be a part of. I went down with Billy Graham to his baseball field in one of the lowest points of my life. I tried to call Billy Graham on the telephone and they kept telling me I'd have to talk to one of his assistants, Sam. And I ain't talking to no damn assistants. I want to talk to the deity at hand. I want to talk to Billy Graham. I want to tell him about me. And they put this dude on the phone, never heard of. He ain't never been on television. He wasn't nothing. But I went down there anyway. And I was probably about half drunk when we got there. They sang Just As I Am and Now I Win. I hit that baseball field just with the rest of them. Just squalling. Got down on my knees and dedicated my life to Jesus Christ. And I got drunk on the way home. Now that's another thing that I don't say facetiously and I don't say it to be funny. I could not hear what those people said. In Chuck Chamberlain's book, he talks about a story called The Prodigal Son, of the young man that spent his inheritance. He asked his father for his inheritance and his father gave it to him. He didn't caution him. He didn't judge him. He just gave him his inheritance. And it tells about the young man that spent his inheritance on riotous living. And he went to the men in that country. And the men in that country couldn't do anything for him. And I went to the men in that country. I went to my peers. I went to my family. And I went to the preachers. I went to Catholic priests and hardshell Baptist preachers. They all said the same thing. They all said, why don't you quit drinking? Why don't you quit drinking? And I was like a man that was in a lake with a big rock, you know, and he's going just by God straight to the bottom. And people would say, why don't you turn the rock loose? And you can come to the top. The rock was the only damn thing I had. I couldn't turn that rock loose. even if I was going to the bottom. We went on vacation sometime, and we were on vacation in 1978, and I had really, really begun to worry about me. Because, like I say, and my wife had told me that I'd begun to get foul-mouthed and mean. And she said, "Now, I know it's your vacation." She doesn't know anything about alcohol either. The poor little thing takes 3 drinks. She wants to take her clothes off and go to bed. She is a normal drinker. But she said that the bourbon makes you foul-mouthed and mean, and the scotch makes you mean, so don't drink that on your own vacation. And I said, "Okay, you get me something that you think I can drink." She came home with a quart of Smirnoff 100-proof vodka. Two little cans of that orange juice, and we started on vacation. She asked me not to tell this story, and I don't remember her doing it, so I'm not going to tell about her beating hell out of me in Richmond, Virginia. But I do remember the next morning she pulled up to I-95 north and south, and she said, "The children and I are going on vacation. Whether you go or not is going to depend on what you're going to do for the rest of this vacation." It was the third step, you see. I had to make a decision. And I said, "Okay, I'll do the best I can, but I can't promise you anything. I can't promise you anything. I'll do the best I can." And for a long time, I really thought I had seen New England, Paul. I thought I had been to those states. And she'd talk about being in Rhode Island, and I'd think, you know, she'd say, "Well, when we were in Rhode Island, I thought, hell, I ain't been to Rhode Island. I don't remember being there. I don't remember being there." But I did the best I could do. I tried to not drink so much. I tried not to pass out but once a day. I tried to gauge that drinking, you know, to keep me growing up in the car. So I could, you know, just get on home with the family. And I learned something else about you folks from the northern tribes. I thought you were a lot more liberal than we were. I didn't have any idea you didn't sell beer on Sunday either. But it was a forced tapering off, I guess, because we got to Niagara Falls, and I went to the store to get some beer, and they said, "You can't buy beer on Sunday till afternoon." We went out and looked at the falls. Anyway, the shaking and the sickness and just the whole bit. And we got to Cleveland and we spent the night there. And from Cleveland all the way back to Tracy City, Tennessee, I didn't have a drink for 14 hours. Now that's the longest I have been without a drink of alcohol, and I don't have any idea when. And I made it. And it didn't hurt too bad. And I began to think, maybe. And I got home and we had another coincidence. My father was another one of these people, they say, you know, bad to drink. I always thought he was pretty good at that, but they said he was bad to drink, and he had gone to AA. And he'd been sober like 2 years. And I remember he used to call me and he'd say, "Son, it's been 6 weeks since I had a drink." And I think that's great. You don't need that. I've done that. It don't work. But I don't think he said anything in particular to me. I think it was just the way he looked. It wasn't the words we say. It's the music we play. And I came home and I knew that something had to be done. And 5 days later, I couldn't go back to work. 5 days later, I woke up at 4 o'clock in the morning. Knew exactly how many beers I had, and I tried to nurse those 4 beers till the store opened at 6 a.m. and I could get some more, and I could drink that beer till the liquor store opened. And I went down to a convenience store, and it was 6:02 or 6:05. It was after 6 o'clock.
And they still had those broomsticks in the door where you can't slide the doors, you know. And I said, friend, it's already after 6. You need to take these sticks out. I worked all night. And I want a couple of beers before I go to bed. That man looked at me with such pity in his eyes. And I know that people had looked at me with pity in their eyes before. But for some reason, the look in that man's face told me that I was through lying to me and to him and to anybody else. I was a drunk. I bought that beer and I went home and I tried to drink one of them and it wouldn't work. I just couldn't drink it. 4 or 5 days prior to this, I got to where I couldn't get drunk anymore. I just drank and got sick. I couldn't get drunk anymore. I think today that the God part of me, the sinner part of me, just decided, no more, we ain't getting drunk anymore. We're not going to run anymore. You can pour that stuff in you for the rest of your life, but we ain't escaping no more. No more hiding. And I walked out on the sun deck and I said, God, I think this is what I said. I said, hell is what I said. And I started crying and I woke my wife up and I said, I got to do something. She said, call AA and I'll call Dr. Lambert. I said, I'll call Dr. Lambert. You call AA. She called AA Central Office and someone named Jim. I always think it was Jim Hicks, whether it was him or not. Called me and told me that there was going to be a meeting in Jim City that night. I went and got my eyes examined, and what that had to do with it, I have no earthly idea. I needed a new pair of glasses to get started. Never worn glasses before in my life. I paid $184 for a pair of glasses. Then a man examined my eyes, and I'd been drunk for 5 weeks. I still got them. Still can't see out of them. But I went to the doctor that morning, you know, and I'd already made this great confession, and I'd already cried. And I began to back off a little, you know. Let's don't get into this too deep. Let's don't make it a big deal out of this thing. And I got to the doctor's office, and I'd already decided on a little story. I could tell him, you know, that I've just been on vacation, and I've been drinking a little too much, and I probably just need something to sort of calm me down so I can get back to work and get into my routine, and I'll be all right. Well, Dr. Lambert was another one of those coincidences. He walked in there and he said, he would look at me. He said, what's wrong with you, Bob? I said, Dr. Lambert, I'm an alcoholic and I can't quit drinking. That ain't what I wanted to tell him. That is not what I wanted to tell him. And he said, well, I'm going to recommend that you go to AA. And I said, no, I'm not going to AA. I've been there. I want to go to the hospital. I want to go to Peaceford Hospital. And he said, okay, if your insurance will pay for it, you'll be all right. You'll be locked up for 28 days, and when you get out, if your attitude has not changed, the first stop you'll make is a liquor store. And I heard he, and I didn't go. I went home and I laid around on the couch and I tried to make it, you know. I knew that meeting was at 8 o'clock and I kept trying to make it, just putting off taking a drink. And it got to be time to go because I had to get my wife to drive me, and we pulled up there in the parking lot of Jim City, St. James Episcopal Church. And she said, Bob, before we go in, do you want to pray? And I said, now don't start that shit. I ain't coming down here to do no praying. I'm coming down here to see what these people are doing. And I don't want to do no praying. And she said, well, just try. And I said, the only prayer I knew, you know, God, if you ever let anything work, let this work. Now, I still got the automobile we went in. So I think today that God didn't know whether he meant the automobile to keep working, me to keep working, or the program to keep working. So until we decide, he's just going to let them all run. But I walked in that meeting that night. Speedy says I waddled in there. See, I weighed about 247, 50 pounds. And I waddled in there, and I heard two things I hadn't heard in a long time. Speedy took one look at me, and he said, "You in the right place." I wonder, how in the hell does he know I'm in the right place? When the meeting was over, he said, "Come back, we'd love to have you." Now, I hadn't heard that in a long time. People hadn't told me to come back, they'd love to have me. And he said something else, you know, that's just as silly and as asinine as anything I ever heard, but I remember what he said. He said, "If you'll come back next week, we're going to talk about sex after death." And everybody was laughing. You know, I thought, what's this hell? Why are they so happy? And I went back. And I kept on going back. And I got down to this. I was almost going to get this red chip. And I had a friend up in Nashville who was in the Air Force. He was a colonel, and he was getting married for the first time, and he was going to have a big bachelor party. It was going to be a big deal. And I was invited to the bachelor party, which was going to be November the 22nd. And November the 16th, I was to get this 90-day chip. And I thought, boy, God really does work. You know, it's going to work out just right. I get that 90-day chip next weekend, it'll be party time. 90 days is enough for anybody. 90 days is enough. The old gentleman that gave me that chip that night chaired the meeting at Gem City, and here's another coincidence. Another coincidence. He happened to be the man that brought the chip system to the state of Georgia, Francis Carter. Somebody you know, I remember. And I think he told me that night, I don't remember the dates, but I think he said, "I've been sober since 1943. And you've been sober 90 days. And both of us are just one drink away from being a drunk." And I smiled and thanked him, but what I was thinking was, "Old man, don't rain on my down parade. I've got 90 days and gone." We got in the motel room in Nashville. Another coincidence. We got in the motel room, and on the way up there, my wife had asked me a couple of times, I said, "Doc, can you do this and not drink?" And I said, "Honey, you know, liquor's everywhere. Alcohol is just a social thing. I've got to get back out with the normal people, and eventually I'm going to have to see if I can do these things and not drink." We got in the motel room, and she said again, you know, just as we were getting ready to go out the door to go to this party, she said, "Bob, do you think you can do this and not drink?" And being a comic, being a smart mouth, I said, "What we're going to do, we're going to be governed by what it says in this Gideon Good book that was laying open on the dresser." And I pointed my finger, and it was the 27th Psalm, and it said something. Bible scholars do not quote me, if we have any. But it said something to the effect that, "Judge me, O Lord, for I have walked in mine integrity. I have walked in the ways of the Lord. Therefore I shall not slide." And she said, "Little fellow, that's divine intervention. That's awful damn close to slip." And we laughed about it. And I went to that party the night, and I said, "Well, you know, just for drill, just to show these old boys how good I am, I'm going over there and drink Fresca and Line, and I'm not going to, I'm going to be up here all weekend. They ain't going to break my scotch. I'll drink it tomorrow night." Another coincidence was that the brother of that person at the wedding that I was going to just happened to be my dad's sponsor in AA. And he showed up the next day, and we told him about that story, and we all laughed about it, about slip and slide. And for some reason, Murray didn't find it particularly funny. He said, "Bob, have you taken the first step?" I said, "My God, Murray, you know, 90 days of them took them all." And he said, "Do you understand being powerless over alcohol?" And
I stayed for that. I didn't stay for the whole deal either. I stayed one more day, and I decided I'd come on home. And I tried one more day. Just another day or two, you know. I really wasn't hurting all that bad, so I thought I'd just try for another day or two. Things started getting just a little easier and a little better, and it got to be nearly time for that blue chip birthday, you know. The ego's coming back. I can do this, you know. Full blown ego coming back. And I decided I needed something real profound to say. I didn't want to just stand up there and mumble, you know, well, I'm grateful to you people for a year, you know. It had to be something profound. And to this day, I'll swear to you, I did not know who said this. It read so good to me, I decided I'd use it. I stood up at Gym City and took that blue chip, and these are the words I said because I looked at them again tonight. I keep them. I keep them to remind me of my ego. The words were, verily I say unto you, I will drink no more of the fruit of the vine until that day I drink it new in the kingdom of God. That's what I said on my first birthday. Now, I didn't know for a long time that that's what Jesus Christ said to the disciples at the Last Supper. This program works anyway. It works anyway. It works for people that want it. And it works for me because I continue to want it. And you know, I see two people here tonight, and I'm going to go ahead and tell this little story. I'm going to back up a little bit. I know we're getting Roy, I think we ought to really have the speaker sit in the same chair. Y'all have to. So when one end gets numb, the other end will shut up. But I got to tell you this little story right quick, and I'll be drawing it to a close. Another coincidence. I got on a freight train in Atlanta one night, and we were having some labor trouble between the union and the company. And on one side of our railroad, the clerks were on strike, and the other people were working. And it was sort of a hairy situation to be in. And I had a brakeman that night who was an older gentleman than me in age, but he was a brand new brakeman. I'd never made a trip with him. And in the process, when I got on the engine, I got all these old keys that I carry out of my pocket like this, and I dropped a white chip in the deck of the engine. And I picked it up, and he said, what you got there? And I said, oh, it's just an old poker chip, and I put it back in my pocket. We got to Chattanooga, and I had the union telling me that I couldn't do something. And the railroad company saying, if you don't do this, we're going to fire you. And I was in trouble. And I called some other people. And they didn't know what to tell me to do either. So I called this fellow up to my room and I said, now Harold, I don't know what you're going to do, but I've already called my wife and she's going to pick me up and I'm just going to go get drunk and hide out till this damn thing's over. And he said, Bob, if you're going to get drunk, why'd you take that white chip? And I said, why? Do you know what that is? And he said, oh yeah, I've been an alcoholic for 10 years. Well, maybe time to quit, they're falling out. But that old boy made some trips with me and he helped me a great deal in the beginning. And I said to him, Harold, where do you go to meetings? And he said, oh, I go to Rebus occasionally. Harold helped build the old Rebus, didn't he, Ed? He was here in the beginning. You know, Harold got religion, and I ain't knocking it, but Harold got religion, and he didn't need AA anymore, and he quit coming. Now, Harold may die. He may not come back. I need people like Harold Jones in my life. I need to be reminded that I'm going to have to spend a lot of time with you. I'm going to have to come to your meetings. And I'm going to have to do the things you ask me to do. But I've become addicted to you. become addicted to coming to these meetings. And God, I used to see them old-timers. And I remember coming here one time and to the old Rivas place, and there was a lady there said she'd been sober 23 years, and she went to 5 meetings a week. And I thought, poor thing, you know, God, she ain't got nowhere else to go. Speedy talking about being sober, I thought, is anybody as arrogant as you are, can't go nowhere else? They'll keep it there. That's the reason I figured he'd come to all these meetings. Then I could go on all night, but I really need to bring it to a close. I've been very fortunate. At 5 years of sobriety, I was as low as I ever been in my life. I broke out stone cold sober, not doing anything, not knowing anything, and not knowing what to do. And another coincidence in my life was the lady showed up at the high place, and she said, "Bobby, have you ever heard of Charlie Parmley?" And I said, "I got no idea who he is." And she said, "He does a big book study. Maybe you'd listen to his tapes." And I listened to his tapes. And I listened to Charlie and a black fellow from Little Rock, Arkansas, who I've come to love like a brother, Joe McQuaney. They told me what my problem was, and I didn't know what my problem was. They explained to me 3 words and how they related to my life. They gave me a definition for 3 words. And those words are allergy, an abnormal reaction to a food, beverage, or substance. They gave me a definition for obsession of the mind, a thought that overcomes all other thoughts, and the craving. I always thought craving for alcohol was when I wasn't drinking. And I always tried to control my drinking when I was. It didn't work. And I found out what those things meant to me. I got an old friend with the railroad that always winds up every talk he ever gives. Most of the things I talk about in these meetings and in this fellowship are things that I heard from somebody else. I didn't come here claiming to know a damn thing, and when I walk out of here tonight, I don't claim to know a damn thing except what you people tell me. I'm beginning to know that I don't know, and I don't need to know. So I'm going to steal his story. He tells one at the close of every talk he gives about a man walking along a country road, and it was in the fall of the year, and it had begun to get cold, and there was a snake laying on the side of the road. Poisonous snake, and the snake was almost froze to death, and he said, "Sir, pick me up and put me in your coat and let me get warm." And the man said, "I can't do that. You're a snake and you'll bite me." He said, "I wouldn't bite. My God, you're going to save my life. You think I'd bite you?" And he said, "Okay, I'll take a chance. One time, I'll take a chance." And he picked that snake up and he put it in his coat pocket. The snake got warm and it bit him. And he threw him down on the ground and he said, "Damn you, you told me you wouldn't bite me." And the snake looked up at him and said, "You know what I was when you picked me up." So sometimes, maybe if you're sitting in a bar, or maybe sometimes if I'm thinking I can handle one, I can remember that snake. I know what it is. I know what it is. And I'd like to close with the words of a great poet, a classic musician, Merle Haggard. The words of these: "You stuck with me through thick and thin. You've watched me lose, you've watched me win. And you picked me up off the ground, and you've never once let me down. And you've put me on a permanent high, and I can fly. I can fly. I can fly."